Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Greetings. This is Paul Holdengraber, your host for The Quarantine Tapes, brought to you by Onassis LA and Dublab. I am thrilled to announce that we have asked various former Quarantine Tapes guests to host, during a week, guests of their choice in total freedom. They have absolute carte blanche. This week I have asked the wonderful writer Walter Mosley to serve as our guide and guest host. I do hope you will enjoy Mosley's choices for this week on The Quarantine Tapes. Thank you so much for listening.
Hello, Katrina Vandenhoevel. How are you today?
Better for talking to you, Walter. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. And I want to thank you for agreeing to be a part of The Quarantine Tapes. This podcast exists to find some solace and some reason in the time of COVID-19 and all the problems that pandemic brings. My interest in talking to you today also covers other events occurring here in the United States that have unfolded concurrently with the virus and, in some cases, might even be entwined with our nation's attempt to survive and even grow during this trying period. As publisher and former editor of the 155-year-old progressive magazine, The Nation, and as an outspoken critic of the political, economic, and prejudicial ills of our country, I believe that your point of view would help shed light on the dark path we've traveled in 2020 and maybe some places that we might arrive in 2021. You know that I'm looking for optimism in these times because I feel that hope is what we need to survive our plights and to actually become a better people, a better nation. I see this pandemic not only as the virus, but also as the struggle for racial equality, gender equality, and very importantly, economic equality. Along with that, we are living through an extraordinary political revolution where most citizens feel that they have to get involved in order to build a world that reflects their aspirations and their values. I guess I'm wondering if we can at least imagine a way to make ourselves stronger, smarter, and more in touch with who we are and what we might become. Even if we're staring into the darkness, what I have to ask you is, if we look hard enough, can we see any shred of light?
Walter, thank you for having me on. You know, we've talked many moons about optimism, pessimism, but I think we talk just a few days after, it'll be long remembered, January 6th, as the day two strands of the American experience. I think a pessimistic strand, an optimistic strand, and both are deeply embedded in our nation's history in this pandemic moment. These strands collided. I think of the Capitol and the hate spewing in the seat of government. Eric Foner, the historian who writes for The Nation, who's written brilliantly about Reconstruction and the racial injustice and the quest for justice in this country's history, said, you know, this country has rarely been a well-functioning democracy, but he had never seen a Confederate flag on the floor of the Capitol, and that was shock. But at the same time that day, we learned that an African-American minister and Jew, John Ossoff, had been elected from Georgia. And Georgia is, you know, this state that witnessed the lynching in 1915 of the Jewish factory superintendent Leo Frank and the transformation of populists into anti-Semites and racists. But we saw emerge in these last weeks and months of a pandemic strafed state and country. The work, the campaign led by Stacey Abrams, the extraordinary African-American woman, politician, strategist. She registered new voters in that state, ran for governor, I believe was cheated out of her victory. And she was extraordinarily optimistic, hopeful, inspiring example of the possibility of change, Walter. And I think we see those two strands collide every day, but perhaps not as dramatically as we saw in this, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, coming off an election in Georgia, which I admit, and you are a better optimist than I am, I think there's a learned pessimism, often on the left, a learned helplessness that we couldn't imagine the victory in Georgia. So I take optimism and inspiration, but that didn't happen, Walter. As you know, optimism requires imagination. It requires work in the trenches, and it requires, reimagining and a reconstruction of habits, thoughts, rituals. So I would end just by saying, there's talk about normalcy, Walter, going back to normal after this pandemic.
Yeah.
Its affliction leaves us. I don't think that is the way to think about it. And I think optimism demands reconstruction, not return.
Well, you know, Katrina, what interests me, of course, I'm never going to be, you know, behind or supporting people who say, well, the way I'm going to achieve my goals in democracy is through violence, intimidation, bullying, whatever those things are. I mean, of course, those things are wrong. But at the same time, when I look at, you know, this, you know, I'm on, you know, the more liberal, more progressive side, you know, of the political spectrum. But when I look at the other side, I said, well, you know, we have a lot of things in common. There are a lot of problems that people have over there. Sometimes they blame me, you know, Black people in America. But, you know, to look beyond that, I'm saying, well, you know, number one, we're not doing this to you. And number two, most things that we haven't, well, most of the problems that we have, those are problems that we have in common. Do you see, through your work, through your talking, through your connections in the world, a possibility of us coming to an understanding, a kind of a dialectical transition?
It's so important, Walter. And you wrote about this belief, and it's not ungrounded hope. It's a belief that people can find commonalities.
Yeah.
I think if you get outside the accursed beltway, you know, I mean, sometimes it's a fiction in people's minds which allow them to scapegoat good people. But there is a world and a life outside the beltway. And I think there's also been a loss of understanding about what inequality and not inequality can be a big word. By the way, let me just step back. It's interesting. Stacey Abrams came into The Nation a few years ago, and it was during the Hillary, Bernie presidential campaign of 2016 before Hillary defeated Bernie in the Democratic primaries. And she said, my constituents, and she was in Georgia, rooted in Georgia, was, you know, when they hear the word inequality, they don't connect to it. It seems far away. Even Wall Street banks seem far away. They're looking for jobs. They're looking for community. They're looking for things that improve the condition of their lives. And often that word inequality can seem far away and big. So it's like economic injustice, justice. And I think if people had a sense of community and had a sense of being listened to, I know, and I don't need to tell you, but there was the stench of white supremacy on the floor of the Capitol the other day. But there was also this rage that people have not been heard and communities are dying. And they've been one of the, I think, the most dangerous things that has happened in the last 40, 50 years is people have been led to believe that government is to be distrusted or is out to get you. It's not there to be at your side. And I think that if we could come back to some agreement to agree on things we can agree on and really disagree on things we disagree on, but not make it a war. You know, I think I told you, Walter, that one of the through lines of The Nation, though it is certainly the quest for a more perfect union and fighting racial injustice founded by abolitionists committed to ending slavery, but is a belief in, you know, misadventures abroad do not allow a real democracy at home. And so I think there's a way to find a commitment to ending endless war. Communities are ravaged. Many poor communities are ravaged by their men and women being sent over to fight wars we shouldn't be in. The day of the Capitol insurrection, I don't call it a coup because I think coup involves power, property, class. It was an insurrection, but it was also the 80th anniversary of Roosevelt's Four Freedoms speech, which, yeah. You know, Roosevelt has lots of issues, internment, not proceeding in any real way on desegregation when he was president, but commitment to freedom of speech, commitment to freedom of religion and worship, commitment to ending fear and ending want. And I think, you know, that speech, I've always loved his Economic Bill of Rights from 1941 even more, because that would have gotten him driven off the floor of the Capitol many years ago. But our politics has changed some. So there's, in my mind, hopeful, optimistic that we're talking about, not only talking, but Medicare for All is popular, more popular than some of the politicians who preach it. It's a long answer, but you think deep about it, about trying to find, not false commonalities, but really trying to find some commonalities, because we're being pitched against each other to the benefit of the today, by the way, the National Association of Manufacturers and Chamber of Commerce, the citadel of capitalism, is being praised because they've come out against Trump. I mean, you know, this is, in my mind, a brand move.
Well, they come out against Trump because he's hurting their profits,
their business,
their bottom line. Yeah. And that's the thing. And, you know, and that's such a hard thing to understand. I mean, another thing that, you know, comes out of the father of socialism, you know, Karl Marx, he talks about the dead hand of the past. And what I'm interested in, there have been a lot of heroes in Georgia, all over the country, doing incredible work, making this a better democracy, a more complete democracy. But there's another thing that, you know, like a lot of people I know, you know, I mean, I know when I was a kid, you know, and we're thinking about, you know, Mississippi, and we're thinking about Georgia, mm-hmm. and we're thinking about, you know, Louisiana, we start saying, oh my God, this is a terrible place. You can't even go there because, you know, you might get killed, which actually was true at one point.
Yes.
But now those places are beginning to change. I'm finding myself, I want to say to people, look, it's different there. People can vote in Georgia. Yeah. And not only can they vote, they can make a difference. And so
absolutely.
You can continue, like, you know, because a lot of people, you know, the North a lot makes fun of the South.
Walter, there was a move on after one of the elections. I don't think it was 2016, because that became so Trumpized and, you know, Russianized. But there was a move on to secede from the South. But there, you're right, there's a blindness and myopia, which I hope the election in Georgia begins to really change. I don't know if it's a new South, that fits into too many cliches, but things are changing. And if you just stay stuck in the past, which, you know, you began with that, it's very dangerous. Now, I do think one has to understand the past, and this is a big insight, sorry. You have to understand the past in order to understand the present and the future. I really do believe that, which is why I reached out to a historian the other day to kind of put into context what we were witnessing on the Capitol floor, around the Capitol, in the midst of so much cable TV. I mean, people were expressing themselves almost as much as conveying the scenes. You know, people had to get on the maybe legitimate bandwagon to condemn Trump as a white supremacist and all the Republicans. One thing I'm hopeful about, optimistic about, Walter, is that people who did not understand the power, the right to vote, many thousands did because they fought for it, they died for it. But a lot of people in this country have believed that our country was a well-functioning political democracy. They didn't really pay attention to the right to vote. I mean, what the Supreme Court has done and the suppression of the vote is far more threatening than a lot of foreign powers' attacks on us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's the threat within or the challenge within. But people now understand they cannot sit back on the sofa. Now, if they want to, that's their right. But I think millions of people are engaged, as you've said, in movements, in their own communities, understanding. Now, too much of it is about Trump in my mind, because I think Trump is also Trumpism. And you know, so that's, you know, and I think when I think of isms, and you talked about Karl Marx, I mean, I think, and this is what I think you are, I'm not going to call you something you're not, but I think humanism is an important ism that can be added to other isms. But if you're not a humanist, you can have utopian ideas, which, you know, we've seen through history, big utopian ideas can end in blood.
In dictatorship, you know, in mass murder and
yes,
in war. Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, let's not assume that until the Capitol in the United States was attacked, that we were a well-functioning democracy, right? I mean, I think the other, you know, I have an issue. It's kind of a tick. I've been in meetings, I'm sure you've been in meetings, Walter, where people say we're leader of the free world. I'm sorry, I can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and so I think the notion that we are the indispensable nation, which has been around for decades, or that we have a right to a triumphalism and the end of civilization with the United States winning the civilization game, I think should be jettisoned right now after these last hours, but they should have been jettisoned years ago, because it's not about, you know, a great nation in my mind doesn't need to boast. A great nation needs to get its act together at home for its own people. And it's not isolationism, but messing around overseas. By the way, we've seen some coups because we participated in quite a few coups.
Well, we've participated in coups. We've interfered in people's elections. We've been part of assassinations of, you know, of, you know, what they call our enemies, and maybe even some of them are. But then a whole bunch of people, you know, just get killed because, you know, they're not doing what we need them to do. We have a government that, you know, that, you know, says it's based on democracy, but a whole lot is based on capitalism, and capitalism is the antithesis of a democracy. But you have to understand that there are good people in Georgia and in Mississippi and in Tennessee.
Yes.
And that you have to believe that if you do right by these people, if we do right by these people, then they, you know, they will understand, hey, this I don't like what he thinks, but, you know, he did right by me.
No, that's right. I mean, if I'm again, I don't want to reduce it to just economic justice. Mm-hmm. And I do we've had arguments, Walter. I mean, I'm about cap because I think when we say capitalism, there are many different kinds of capitalism in my view. There's unfettered, Wild West, crude kind of capitalism, speculative casino, which we've seen too much of in these last decades. But there's also kind of social democracy.
Yeah.
Capitalism. And I know. You know, and Bernie Sanders would always go on about Denmark, and finally we sent him a letter saying, Bernie, can you cut it out with Denmark? Can you refer to this country's own clashes with unfettered capitalism? But I to say something heretical, there are also, and this has been a terrible for the United States and other countries, thinking of Vietnam specifically, but or Cuba, what's been done to Cuba in the last couple of years under Trump is just criminal. But there are different kinds of communism too, which may be heretical to say, but
oh my God, there's all kinds of problems with communism. I mean,
I know, but Cuban capitalism
doesn't work. When I say capitalism, there's not an echo of communism inside of that. It's just I'm saying, well, you know, when somebody owns everything and travels as if they're above the law in ways, if when somebody runs a system in where most people are headed toward poverty, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, that I'm thinking about. And listen, this upsurge of voting, you know, of participating in that part of democracy, a lot of which has to do with Trump, because Trump raised so many people who are going to vote for him. The other side said, well, we got to vote against them voting for him. So all of a sudden you have a country that's engaged. I think that's wonderful. The more we're engaged, the more we can control.
I think that the results in Georgia, when I say results in Georgia, it speaks to what you're speaking about, Walter, which is a recognition that this country is changing, and it's kind of slap people in the face in a nonviolent way. What happened in Georgia cannot be denied, but it's also, you know, Trump's imminent departure is an opening for a kind of revitalization of what has been a flawed, you know, what we've been talking about, a flawed democracy. And I think, you know, what was stunning to me is when you saw the people on the floor, and we spend more than any country, any other nation on our military, more than 7 countries, 10 combined. These were not enemies at the gate, quote, enemies, which we've made our, you know, adversaries, China, Iran, Russia. These were people from the states we're talking about, many states, this country from within. And I think it's important. The other word we haven't talked about is near the great at this is understanding, trying to understand the rush to condemn. I'm not saying you condone, but it's important to understand. And I think we need a measure of that in, and we've talked about this, Walter, about social media, the velocity of comment, of discussion, of fake debate often, because it's just posturing often, gestural. It's not healthy, it seems to me, yeah, for our being.
All right, so taking everything that you're saying into account, we're looking, you know, into this year that we just entered, 2021. And, you know, we have issues, you know, there's a vaccine around, people seem to know a little bit more about the disease. We've learned something. If I were to be optimistic, I'd say, well, I'm glad that we dealt with COVID-19 and not some variant strain of Ebola. We'd all be dead if that was the case. But maybe we've learned something.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's me. I'm saying this, and well, you know, there's optimism in everything. Maybe we've learned how to deal with something by experiencing this.
I think you're right, Walter. I think it's very difficult. First of all, it's global. And I think there's a sense of interconnectedness that has kind of been jettisoned over the years, like we're an island unto ourselves. But I also think what it's revealed is like an MRI of the country. It's revealed pre-existing conditions of racial division, economic division, of housing injustice, the disproportionate impact of disease and problems on the poor, the brown, the black, Native Americans. And I think that can't be denied. How we address it as a country is going to demand, again, movements, but Walter, I hope not fractured, balkanized movements, but a coalition of common interests. Understanding that, you know, we're one, it's very hard to do that in this climate. But that's what I think the pandemic has exposed. And this, again, the idea of going back to normal. We're not going to go back to normal. And it's not just the big issues of economic justice, but it's also so many of us, I think, who had good fortune, were doing a lot of things that just, you know, were not necessary for living a decent life. So I think there'll be a sense of,
like what, Katrina?
Well, I'm thinking we rushed around, like we went to meetings and we had to be everywhere and everything. And the idea of being more mindful about space, time, resources, and I mean, you know, climate too, but, you know, and being with friends and family, I think those are very important to, and people, so many people have died, Walter. I mean, there's a sense of what is security, right? We've had a false sense of security for too many decades.
Yeah.
It's not about the biggest weapon. It's about how we treat each other, how we take care of each other. And the fact that so many have, the numbers are staggering. So I think that needs to sober us so that we become a more caring country. As I said earlier, stop prancing around with, you know, triumphalism. I think it should make us more sober and think harder about where we head in this period. And I do think reconstruction, we may be in a fourth reconstruction, but I think that's a kind of parallel to what we need to think about moving forward. And understanding what you say about capitalism, I agree with you in the sense that there's often talk of how there's not enough money. I mean, there's money, people find money for lots of things, right? But when it's human needs, or, you know, I think that's always, no, there's not enough money. And the last thing I'd say is I think people, the balance between hope, optimism, and realism. I always feel there's a purpose to realism, grounded pragmatism, radicalism, but not to demobilizing people with cynicism or hopelessness. And I think that's often, by the way, part of what a more corporate media tries to do, which is make people spectators, not participants. And I hope the nation has always fought that. But that's sort of what I think coming out, we could begin to, you know, dig deeper, think harder about where we come out.
I know that you're a publisher of The Nation, used to be, you know, the editor-in-chief, yeah. but even in your most control of the organ of the magazine, you never spoke for it. Everybody else spoke. Everybody else came together and talked and decided, you know, where to go, how to go, things like that. But that said, what do you think that an organization like yours, you know, the publication, The Nation, how can it start to mend some of the rifts between the people who have so much in common?
I believe that by lifting up ideas that have relevance, like Medicare for All, Walter.
Mm-hmm.
Truly, it is a popular program. And don't forget, when Medicare itself was introduced, or Social Security, they were called socialist ideas.
Mm.
But I think the nation has championed, you know, a Green New Deal, which is essentially a jobs program, and Medicare for All, and obviously, you know, expanded universal care and leave and all of these, and peace, not, you know, not just using that word without recognizing what that would take. It's not just without war, it's with justice. But I think that part of our role is to champion those ideas and champion those figures in the movements and inside our politics, who are allies and who can change the kind of drift of a country divided, and not failing to recognize that we are not the perfect union. We need much work. But I think that's important. And I want to end with a story why I always, it's about Martin Luther King Jr., who was our civil rights correspondent from 1961 to 67. Mm-hmm. Reverend Barber is now our civil rights correspondent. But I remember going to hear Reverend Barber at Riverside Church on the 50th anniversary of King's speech against the Vietnam War. He gave it April 1967. And his allies in the civil rights community and liberal communities advised him not to, really warned him. And I went back to the New York Times editorial and the Washington Post editorial, and they chastised him. They were scathing and denouncing him.
Yeah.
The nation lifted him up as a prophetic voice, both for his anti-war statement, but also in challenging, as the creative dissenter he believed he was, and he was, in speaking for that prophetic principle. And I, you know, you realize then the nation was outside its, you know, was a maverick voice and a voice that people who didn't feel themselves comfortable in a mainstream listened to. And I think we need to challenge what is conformist and be nonconformist. And the only thing I would say, and I'll grateful to you for listening to me go on, is joy. I think that too often the left, the progressive left, gets tedious, gets schematic, gets caught up. And I wrote you about joy. I mean, I am a Goldman, but they're just basic, having a good time listening to each other, the music, the culture.
What is it that Emma Goldman said again?
She said, I don't want to dance. If I can't dance to it, it's not my revolution.
All right. Yeah.
And so, you know, it's, I think it's something to keep close by. Whoever said it.
No, it's true. If I can't dance to it, it's not my revolution. I think that's, you know, that's us dancing all by itself is us working together.
That's right.
You know, and
it takes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to tango, you know?
Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, anyway, Katrina, thank you.
I'm very grateful for your friendship, and I'm grateful that you have sat through too many Nation editorial board meetings. And in fact, a decade or more ago, you came through with an idea that is now at the centerpiece of the Democratic Party platform, just to give people some cash. And all the big brains, and they're good people. They said, what? Anyway, you were onto it.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting notion. You know, I'm glad you have me there. You know, I consider myself a pedestrian thinker. And in that, you know, I think that everyday people have great ideas, and they need to recognize them. And experts very often are the opposite of great ideas, even though they're smarter.
It's so true.
And
extraordinary, ordinary people, ordinary, extraordinary people.
Mm.
That's where some of the great ideas and the courage comes from.
And I think that's the gift that America can have for all of its citizens, you know, but we got to work at it.
Yep.
And with optimism. With optimism, right. And dancing.
And dancing. So I want to continue talking to you soon. But I'm grateful for you inviting me on your broadcast.
And thank you so much, Katrina. It's great to be able to talk to you, and it's great for you to take your time to do this.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.